The Gospel of John was written to help people believe and find real life. John presents proofs for and insights into the fulfilling life of a believer. We will give special attention to coming back to God after you have fallen.
We are trying our best as a congregation to go through the entire Bible this year. So we've made it to the New Testament. We're to the fourth of the four Gospels. The first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are frequently referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. Very similar. So if you read Matthew and then you read Mark, it's kind of like, hey, I've read a lot of this before, right? Maybe just a little bit briefer or a little bit different perspective in Luke. When you get to John, though, John's not part of the Synoptic Gospels, kind of written from a little bit different perspective. And he's going to tell us what that perspective is. And that's what we're going to try to get into this morning. If you want to follow along in your Bibles, I am going to have a couple of the verses up here on the screen, but we're going to be looking at the very end of the Gospel of John. So if you want to turn to the last couple of verses of chapter 20 and then 21, that's the way that the gospel ends up. That's where we're going to spend our time in the Word. While you're turning there, I want to tell you about a guy. I think I've mentioned this guy before. I really like this guy. His name's Charles Blondin. I don't know if you've heard of Charles Blondin before or not, but almost to the day, 166 years ago, in fact, it was the last day of June in 1859, he and his team strung a tightrope across Niagara Falls. And he's the guy. He's the guy who walked on the tightrope across Niagara Falls. The Smithsonian Magazine talks about this. They talk about 25,000 people coming out to watch this. In fact, in typical 1859 journalistic style, it said the little children were hiding behind the mother's dresses, you know, as they watched this man get out there. And some of the critics said, you know, it was just foolishness. Why? Because he didn't just walk across the rope. When he got towards the end, he broke out into a jog, a run towards the end of the line. They thought, you know, you're tempting fate, right? Well, evidently it made a lot of money for him because he did it again and he did it again and he did it again. But after you've done this dozens of times, less people come out. So you have to add to the show a little bit. So here, this, by the way, real picture, this is his manager. His manager is a guy by the name of Harry... Harry Colcorn. And he talked Harry Colcorn, not just posing for this picture, to get on his back. He literally talked him into getting on his back when he went on the tightrope out there over at Niagara Falls. Right? Well, again, according to the Smithsonian Magazine, they said part of that speech, one of the journalists overheard them talking to each other before he got on his back and went on the tightrope. And in essence, here's what Blondin, which, by the way, not his real name, stage name, He's from France. Don't really know that I can pronounce his real name, so I'm just going to call him Blondin, right? He's talking to Colcorn, and he says, listen, when we get out there on the rope, Colcorn no longer exists. You're part of Blondin now. He says, when I move, you move. When I sway, you sway. If you try to move on your own, and you try to balance us, we're both dead. Right? But as long as you stick with me and become one with me, everything's going to be just fine. Well, it was fine, right? Because he followed these instructions, and he really did stay with him. As a preacher, I got to tell you how I love that story. Because, you know, most of the time when we get into trouble, it's because we take matters into our own hands, right? Instead of listening to what the Word says, instead of trusting what Jesus has promised He will do for us, instead we take matters into our own hands, and that's usually where the trouble comes. But here's the real reason I put this up here. My favorite all-time story with Blondin is the one where he actually pushed a wheelbarrow out there on the tightrope over in Niagara Falls, right? And after he pushed that wheelbarrow out there, he even had bricks in it, he came to the side, and again, thousands of people come out because they didn't have TV back then, right? So thousands of people come out to watch this, and he says to them, how many of you believe I could actually push a person in this wheelbarrow? And I'm guessing, you know, the people who heard about or actually saw him take his manager on the back, there's probably a whole bunch of people saying, yes, yes. In fact, almost the whole audience, according to the reporters, they all said, yes, we believe you. And then he said, okay, who volunteers to get in? All right? The reason I love this story so much is this really helps illustrate the difference between what the Bible calls just simple belief, kind of belief in James chapter 2, it says even the demons have, versus faith. What is faith? In a nutshell, can I say it this way? It's a getting in the wheelbarrow kind of belief. You know, it's not just assent. It's not just saying, I believe that can happen. It's willing to trust. Now, there's another reason why I like this illustration so much. It doesn't just illustrate what we're talking about with faith. It makes another extremely important point about faith. Too many people have this idea that reason's over here and faith is over here, right? Science versus faith, reason versus faith. Nothing could be further from the truth. Because when you talk about real faith, it permeates all of life. I don't care if you're the strictest scientist in the world, you still have to have faith. What kind of faith? You have to trust your senses, right? That you're seeing, that you're observing. Sometimes you trust your instruments that you're using for whatever laboratory experiment you're doing. It may be a lot less faith than what other people have, but nonetheless, everybody has to exercise some faith. Here's the real important aspect of faith. It's not just a trusting belief. What makes faith great is what your faith is in. It's the object of your faith. Can I go back to this illustration one more time? If Blondin were to say, you know, trust me, get in the wheelbarrow, that'd be one thing. If Mark Bourne went out on a tightrope and said, trust me, get in the wheelbarrow, you'd have really silly faith to get in the wheelbarrow for something like that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Right? Some people are more trustworthy than other people. Here, in a nutshell, in my estimation anyway, this is what the Gospel of John's all about. It is saying, God is worth your total trust. And guess what? You'll really find what life is supposed to be if you have that get in the wheelbarrow kind of relationship with him. Now, why do I say that? Because at the end of the Gospel of John, he tells us, you know, sometimes people give their thesis statement right up front. Other times they give it at the end. John gives it at the end of his gospel, at the end of his book. So here are the last two verses of John chapter 20. It says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not recorded in this book. That's one of the reasons why you can read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you can read some stuff. I mean, he does repeat some of the things that are in the other gospels. But a lot of the other things in the gospels, he doesn't even bother to bring up anymore because it's not part of the reason why he's writing, right? So here's what he says. He says, there are many other signs that he performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written so that you may believe. By the way, this is not talking about just assent. This is the same root word for the biblical word faith. Can I say it this way? It's a get in the wheelbarrow kind of belief, right? Are you with me? So he says, I have written these signs have been recorded that you may have that kind of faith, that kind of belief, that Jesus is the Messiah. That's the promised one of God, right? The one who's coming to fulfill all these promises. The Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, by having that kind of trusting faith, you may have life in his name. Okay, again, in the Greek language, Koine Greek, the kind of Greek that the New Testament was originally written in, there are two different words for the word life in the English language. One word in the Greek language is bios. You know where we get biology, the study of life, so just being alive, existing, right? That would be bios. That is not the word that he uses here. The word in the Greek language here is zoe. I don't know if you've heard this before or not, but it's a wonderful word because this word for life means to really be alive, right? To experience life the way it was meant to be experienced. So take this with me and let's put this together, right? He says, the purpose of this writing is to present you with enough facts and information so that you can rationally come to the point to say, I'm going to trust that. I'm going to trust in him. And when you trust in him, you know what you're going to find? You're going to find that you get the answers to the most basic questions that everybody has about life. You're going to start experiencing life the way God created you to experience. You get this? Okay. How does John do this? What's the outline of the book? Let's take a step back and let's just get kind of the structure of the book. Totally different from the other gospel writers, right? He's writing a little bit later. So here's what he does. There's the first chapter is kind of introduction. And then there's a chapter at the end. Chapter 21 is kind of the conclusion. The main bulk, though, is divided into two halves. Chapters 2 through 11 of the Gospel of John, you're going to be confronted with seven major signs, right? Seven wonderful examples of powerful things that only Jesus could do. Now, push pause for just a second. Think about this. When John wrote this, we already know the purpose of the writing, right? He wants you to look at this information and come to a rational conclusion. Nobody could do that but God, right? That's what he wants us to conclude, right? In so writing, though, this makes me think of 1 Corinthians chapter 15. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Apostle Paul says, listen, Jesus, after he rose from the dead, he appeared to many different people. In fact, over 500 at one time. And then he makes this point. Many of them are still alive. Now, why does he throw that in? I think one of the reasons he throws that in is this. He's saying, listen, if you want to go talk to some of these people, check it out for yourself, right? Have you thought about this? When John wrote this, it would have been easy for people to go to Cana, to go to Bethsaida, to go to Jerusalem, to go to some of these places and look for people. Hey, did you hear about, did you meet the person who was born blind? Were you here that day? They could have run this down. Do you understand the significance of this? He's not just making up stories here. He's giving information like in a courtroom. Here's Exhibit A, here's Exhibit B, here's Exhibit C. And when people would look into this, it would be like, whoa, right? First half of the book, right, chapters 2 through 11, seven major signs that give proof. Then chapters 12 through 20, most of this, folks, is just one night. Over a third of the book is just one night. In fact, half the book's 1 week, right? So it's like, here's the proof for Jesus. Now let's experience Jesus. Let's see him with his disciples in that final meal, right? Oh, it's beautiful, and I don't have time to get into any of that. So my remaining time, here's what I do want to focus on. How does John introduce the book, and how does he conclude it? Because all this is making a powerful point, but I think there's some real wisdom at looking at how does he introduce this, and how does he conclude it? So chapter 1. John chapter 1, very first verse says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Remember that verse? Powerful verse, right? Okay, that word for word is not the word for word in the Greek language. The word for word in the Koine Greek language is rhema, and he uses a different word here. The word he uses is the word logos. And you can translate that word. That's a perfectly good translation of the word logos, right? But the word logos is so, they've written books on this one word. But in a nutshell, here you go. It's where we get the word logic. Now think about this, because we already know the purpose of the book, right? You know what he's saying right up front? In the beginning was logic. In the beginning was rationality. In the beginning was the answer to everyone's questions. And it's God. And he came into this world. Would you just think about that with me for just a second? If God never came into this world, we'd all be here scratching our heads. Right? What's it about? Why are we here? What are we supposed to be doing? But he came into the world to give us answers to the most important questions, to make sense out of this world, right? I know I'm glossing over this quickly, but that's pretty much the first several verses of the book. That's why he introduces it. After that introduction, he gives us an illustration. He's going to do the same thing at the conclusion of the book. He's going to make a point and give us an illustration. So here you go. He makes that point, and then here's the illustration. The illustration is about a guy named Philip. Philip meets Jesus, and it's like, whoa, he really is the Messiah. He's the fulfillment of all these promises, right? So Philip gets it. Light bulb comes on. And then he goes and he talks to one of his friends named Nathanael. And he comes up to Nathanael and he says, Nathanael, we have found the promised one from God. You know, it's kind of like the one we've been looking for, the one we've been, right? We have found him. He brings meaning to life. It's Jesus of Nazareth. And as soon as he says that, Nathanael says, you got to screw up your face when you say this, by the way. Nathanael says, Nazareth? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Let me tell you a couple reasons why I like this story so much. I like this story so much because when you've done your research, right? Maybe you were brought up in church, but somewhere along the line, you ask yourself the question, why do I believe this, right? So you've done your homework, you've done your research, and you've come to a place where, you know what? I think this is true, and I trust. I really do. And when you come to that point, usually you want to share it with other people, right? You want other people to know this. And so you tell some friends or you tell some family members. And if you were thinking to yourself, I'm just going to go tell them that I've really found meaning and purpose in life. This is wonderful. And they're going to say, oh, great. Let me come along with you. That's usually not the way it goes down. Usually you tell somebody else about what you believe and they screw up their face and they say, church? Why are you going to church? Or Jesus? Why are you one of those people who follow Jesus? Right? Right? It usually doesn't go as well as we wanted it. Every now and then it does, and praise God when it does, but usually they don't give us a good reception, right? That's what one of the reasons I like this story. Because what does Philip do? Does Philip say, give me your best arguments and I'll give you my best? No. Does he have a debate? No. Which, by the way, we do have answers for questions. But he doesn't go there yet. You know what he does? He says, come with me. Come and see. I don't know if he put his arm around him or not, but in my mind, he put his arm around him. Right? Here's what I like. When we share our faith with other people, because it's not just something we believe, it's a get in the wheelbarrow kind of experience that has made life different for us. And we really do want other people to experience that, right? They don't always receive it well. I really do think one of the best things we can do, instead of arguing or getting upset, one of the best things we can do is just say, why don't you come to church with me? Why don't you come read the Bible with me? Why don't you come and have a cup of coffee and let's talk about some of these things with me? Let's just work through this together, right? And you know what? He did that with Nathaniel. And before you get done with the first chapter, Nathaniel's like, yes, he really is. Promise one from God, right? So that's the way the book starts. And then he gives us all this proof and he focuses on Jesus. Here's the way the book concludes. It concludes with this powerful statement. You can find what life is all about if you really trust him. And then here's the story. And oh, it's a powerful story that he concludes the book with. It's about Peter. And I got to set this up. Remember what Peter did before Jesus went to the cross? Remember when Jesus told his disciples, you're all gonna deny me, you're all gonna flee, you're all gonna run? Remember what Peter said? Oh, they may run, not me. They may let you down, I won't. It's as though he's saying, I promise you, I will never let you down. Why? Because he felt that convicted, right? What did he do? Jesus turned to him when he said that. He said, before the rooster crows twice, you're going to deny you even know me three different times. And he did. And after that happened, when he heard the rooster crow, remember what he did? Went out and he wept bitterly. Okay, that's the story. That's the background to the verses we're going to read. But I got to tell you something else first. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Milgram experiment. Have you ever heard about this? Back in 1961 at Yale University, there was a professor there by the name of Milgram. He got together with some of the other social scientists and psychiatrists and psychologists, and he told them about this experiment that he wanted to do. And before they ever did the experiment, everybody thought, you know what, you're kind of wasting your time because less than 1%, as best we can tell, less than 1% are going to be susceptible to what you think they're susceptible to. Well, he went ahead and he ran the experiment anyway. In a nutshell, I put the name up here so that you can look at the details if you want to look this up later. They did this dozens of times, by the way. First time they did it, 1961, Yale University. Put an ad in the paper. They told people it was an experiment about education, learning, right? That's not what the experiment was really about. But people came in thinking they were going to participate in an educational experiment. And so what they did, it's this person named L in this diagram. He's the one that is the only one who doesn't really know what's going on in this experiment, right? This guy back here is in a lab coat and he's explaining everything. what happens is this guy is sitting at a desk. In fact, here's a picture of a real participant sitting at this desk with control knobs. He had this device in front of him, and it was explained to him that in the next room, there was going to be a person hooked up to electrodes, going to hook him up, and he's the guy sitting in the next room right behind the wall. And he was told, you're supposed to read into the microphone a question and listen for the answer that comes over the speaker. And if he gets the answer wrong, you're supposed to hit the button. The button sends an electrical shock. That's why the guy's wired up. And then if he gets the answer wrong and you hit the button and he gets an electrical shock, you're supposed to turn the voltage up. Then if it happens again, every time you hit the button, you turn the voltage up. Well, clearly marked on the machine in front of him was dangerous, lethal levels of electricity going through this thing, right? Here's what all the psychologists thought ahead of time. Nobody, maybe less than 1%, will go all the way. As the test progressed and the person kept getting the answers wrong, because remember, this is all staged, right? When he got the answers wrong and they'd push the button, the guy sitting here that they're really observing, when he pushes the button and it sends an electrical shock, he hears through the wall the guy on the other side going, oh, like it really hurt him, right? And then as he turns the voltage up, he hears louder screams until eventually he hears the guy on the other side through the wall. Here's the guy saying, I have a heart condition. I need to stop. And so some of these participants would turn around and look at the guy in the white lab coat. The guy in the white lab coat would simply say, it's important that you continue the experiment. You know how many people went all the way? In fact, they didn't just go all the way. The screams got to the point where they stopped. So it was every indication they had literally killed the person on the other side of the wall because they were no longer screaming. It wasn't less than 1%. 67% of people in that situation went all the way up and gave them the maximum voltage. And after the fact, people are like, they can't believe that they did it. But they did it! The psychologists couldn't believe they did it. In fact, that's why they repeated this test so many times. In fact, to this day, that happened back in 1961, to this day, they still debate why it is that people in certain situations will do things that they never thought they would do. I have no answer for that part. I'm just trying to make the point that just about everybody has an experience in their life where they can't believe they did something. I never thought, just like Peter, I will never deny the Lord. I will never do stuff like that. Oh, yeah? And the real point I'm trying to make here is this. It's not just you. Just about everybody you know. You know, a lot of people like to bury this, like to pretend things like this have never happened. But almost everybody has something that they would pay almost any amount of money to go back and relive. If they could go back to that day and not do it, or if they could go back to that day and do what they failed to do, you know what I'm saying? Almost everybody has an experience like that. That's what makes Peter's story so powerful. Because how does Jesus deal with this? Are you ready for these last few verses? Peter is just, he went out and wept bitterly because he's in shambles. So what happens after Jesus rises from the dead is just a few days later, Jesus recreates the scene. He was at a fire when he denies the Lord three different times. You know what Jesus did? He made another fire, prepared some fish for them on the shore. When they come ashore, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Just a couple nights ago, you said, everybody else is going to let you down. I won't. They may let you down, but I won't. In essence, can I say it this way? He's rubbing his nose in it. Are you really better than other people, Peter? Do you love me more than these? Notice how Peter responds. Yes, Lord. He said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said to him, son of John, do you love me? And he answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said, take care of my sheep. And the third time, he's going to go there a third time. He said to them, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him three times. Of course he's hurt. Not just that he's asking him three times. You know what this means? He's reliving this whole event. Before I wrap this up, can I just ask the question? Why recreate the scene? Why go through this again? I mean, there's experiences in life that we never want to think about again. Why is it Jesus is bringing that right back up in our face? Here's my short answer to this, and forgive me for the lousy illustration, but we're not talking about an extinguisher that can put out a fire in a little trash can. You don't need that when your house is burning down. You need the kind of fire extinguisher that can take care of any size fire. And the point Jesus is making is, get it out all on the table. I don't care how far you've gone, how low you sank. I don't care how bad it was. I can deal with that. And he makes him relive this whole thing. And he says, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. He makes him relive this whole thing so that Peter would get back in the wheelbarrow. I can handle this. But it's not just get back in the wheelbarrow, trust me again. Peter, you couldn't handle your sin in the first place. It was never about you. I'm the only one who could ever do that. Right? But he keeps saying, take care of my lambs, feed my sheep. What's that all about? Satan sometimes has victory in our lives when he gets us to sin, doesn't he? But sometimes he has a double victory when our sin takes us out of the game and sidelines us. Have you ever heard anybody say, have you ever said, I really don't deserve to be involved? None of us do. Now, would you get back in the wheelbarrow and get back in the game? Does this make sense? 1 Kings 19, Elijah, one of the greatest prophets in the Old Testament, wanted to die. When God pulls him aside, fascinating how God deals with him. But the last thing God says to Elijah is, get back to work. Get back in the game. I would really love to stop right here, but I can't. Because I'm afraid too many times we think, okay, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to join this and I'm going to do that. And that's not what we're talking about. You know what it means to get back in the game? You know what it means to feed the sheep? Here you go, Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 through 20. Jesus said, at the conclusion of his ministry, before he goes back up into heaven, he says, all authority in heaven and on earth, all authority has been given unto me. You want to know who the authority on life is? On the life to come? You want to know the one who has the answers? Jesus is just making a statement. That's me. And after saying that, he says, therefore, since I know about life, since I know how life is supposed to be lived, therefore, you go to the nations, you make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit, and teach them everything I've commanded you. He's saying you go and you baptize and you teach. Why? Because all that goes around one main thing he said, and here it is. You are here to make disciples. What's a disciple? Somebody who follows Jesus. You know what we're here for? Wherever people are, no matter how close, no matter how far, we're here to say, come with me. Let's get a little bit closer. Come to church with me. Come study the Bible with me. Let's have some coffee together and let's talk about Jesus with me. So I can get you closer to him. Get back in the wheelbarrow. And get back in the game. Would you bow your heads? When you're ready, would you come to the table and remember what Jesus has done for you? And examine your own life and see what you're doing for him, right? When you're ready, would you come to one of the tables and participate in the communion service?
Thanks again for listening to the Brevard Christian Church podcast. We pray you were encouraged and blessed. Want to connect with us? Go to brevardchristian.com and hit the Contact Us page. We'd love to follow up with you and help you take your next step as we get closer to Him. And until next time, grace and peace to you.